Welcome to On the Way with Tony Crisp. Each weekday, Dr. Crisp will be discussing biblical passages, people, places, and prophecies. Tune in daily to start your day right and deepen your understanding of how to better walk the way and enjoy the journey. Here's your host, Dr. Tony Crisp.
Welcome to On the Way. This is Tony Crisp, and this is podcast 1110. Yesterday, we started in Hebrews 11 and Hebrews chapter 12, which we're going to be using as our basis for this series, A Great Cloud of Witnesses. And today, I'm going to be dealing with a passage in the Gospel of Mark. But before we get to that, I want to review what we went over yesterday. First of all, I talked to you about the explanation of faith as it is listed in Hebrews chapter 11. Now, whatever faith is, it is impossible to please God without it. So we need to understand what it is and what it's not, specifically as it relates to salvation, because that is where the shoe leather meets the road. And the book of Hebrews chapter 11 and verses 1 and 2 talk about what faith is, and it is a line item explanation of what faith is. And it is the substance of things hoped for, the things expected, and the evidence, the reality of things not seen. And it was through whatever this faith is that saved Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, all of those before and all of those after them. Whatever that is, we need to know what it is so that we are assured of our calling and election. And that's what the Apostle Paul said, that every one of us need to make our election, our calling, very sure. And so I want to make sure as we go through this that when we talk about faith, we're all talking about the same thing. Secondly, I talked about how that God uses passages like Hebrews chapter 11 and Hebrews chapter 12 to show us vividly not only the illustration of faith, but actually how he explains things, how he illustrates things, how he applies things. And this is instructive for us, those of us who are teaching. And by the way, everyone is a teacher if you're alive. If you're a parent, you're a teacher. If you are anyone that works with anyone else, you are a teacher. It's not just formal teaching. It's not just the gift of teaching. Some of the greatest teachers I have ever known have not been the ones that are gifted teachers. They might have the gift of mercy, and that's just what it takes to reach someone and to lead a small group or even to lead a smaller church, especially someone with a supernatural gift of mercy that has acquired the skill of teaching. So don't get this idea that if you don't have the spiritual gift of teaching that you cannot teach in your local assembly. No, no, no. Because the skill of teaching can be acquired. That's why some are just natural, supernatural, godly, gifted, anointed teachers, but others have just acquired the skills of presenting material in a way that it can be understood. And God blesses that. God uses that. And so that's what Hebrews chapter 11 and 12 does for us, is it gives us a template. It gives us a paradigm. It gives us a way that we can understand how good teaching is done. By the way, all good teaching, if it is going to be consistent, if it's going to be Bible teaching, you take a text and you need to know what the text says. That's called exegesis, and that's the Greek word exegete or exegesis, which means to read out of something, to bring out something. You see, good teaching starts with the understanding of what the text says. That is, what does the Bible say? Not what does it mean to me. That's ridiculous. It doesn't matter what it means to you or how you feel about it. What we want to know is what does God say and what does God mean by what he says, because whatever he says is what he means and he means what he says. And so as you read the Bible, you need to know what the text says. What does it mean? That's the first element in what we call expository teaching or preaching, or what we would refer to as those who lay it out so you can know what the text says, is explanation. Now, many times that is colored and helped and aided and enhanced by knowing the language and knowing the nuances and shades of meaning, because you can add color to that. But you can know what the text says nowadays. There's no excuse for anybody not being a great teacher today, really, from the standpoint of knowledge, because there's so many tools. If you've never taken Greek or Hebrew or Aramaic in your life, you can know just exactly what the text says, because we have so many tools today that are free, available online. You don't have to buy one book. You can get all online. You don't even have to pay for that. So much of it, I'm talking about 95% of it's free. There may be programs that you buy that give you greater depth and give you a greater variety of books and references. But most of what you do, if you dig it out, you can get it online now. And it's amazing. And so all to say, there's no reason for anyone not to be an expository teacher or preacher. And that means explaining the text. You've got to do explanation. Tell people what God says. Learn it yourself. Apply it yourself. All of those things. But if you're going to teach, you've got to have the element of explanation. That is what Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 1 is doing about faith. It's explaining it. The rest of chapter 11 deals with illustration. That is, that faith, that element that was explained, defined, the definition is illustrated. It is illustrative all the way through the rest of chapter 11. The illustrations of a text are like windows that let light into a room in a dark place, something that might not be easily seen. You open up the windows and you can see it very easily. And so the illustrations are like windows, if you will, that will help to bring light on something. So God says, I know this is an abstract, transcendent concept, an idea, faith. You can't see it or touch it or anything like that in its essence. And so he explains what it is, yes, but he illustrates it through the life of Abel, of Noah, of Enoch, of Abraham, on and on and on. All of these people were people who walked by faith. They knew what it was and they lived it out. But then chapter 12 deals with the application of that, because we understand what faith is, and now it's been illustrated what faith is, then the writer of the book of Hebrews says, now you need to apply this to your life, because God set a course out for you, and he set a course out for me. He has a lane for us to run in. He has a direction for us to run to. And so he says, we already have one that's gone before us. He's gone as the scout. He's gone as the one who started it all. He's going to finish it all. And his name is Jesus. And he endured the discipline and endurance that it takes to get to the end. So let you and I lay aside every weight that holds us back, that slows us down, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. Let's set the course and go on that course. Just remember that great expository teaching and preaching has the concept in it of explanation. It has illustration and it has application. So what is this saving faith? When I talk about saving faith, that is a modifier. So you mean there's other kinds of faith? There's other kinds of belief? Yes. And in other languages, it is articulated. We just call it belief and faith, and we don't have many modifiers for that. We don't have much explanation. In other languages, they do. For instance, faith can be intellectual assent. That is, you know something in your mind, and that is a part of saving faith, is knowing. But it is a census. It is giving intellectual assent. You see, we have in the West the idea, if we can just get someone to agree with us and they understand the facts about Jesus and they pray some prayer, that there's some kind of faith transaction that takes place. That may be so, or it may not be so. This is why Jesus told the parable that we're about to read and others to describe what it really means to believe, saving faith. In Mark chapter 4, he says, and again, this is verse 1, Mark 4, And again, he began to teach by the sea. That's Kinneret. That is the Sea of Galilee. That's a freshwater lake, 7.5 miles wide, 14 miles long, 150 feet deep. The number one fish out of the 27 plus species that are in it is the freshwater sardine, which you caught in nets or seines, we would call them in the South. And many times they fished right by the shore, would go out in a boat. And we have various instances of that in the New Testament. This is where they were. And Jesus is walking by the sea, and it says that they started gathering to him, a great multitude gathered to him, so that he got into a boat and sat in it on the sea. Sometimes when we talk about sea, the Hebrew word is yam, which is not just always referring to the Mediterranean, or in our case, the Atlantic or the Pacific, or wherever you are, some ocean or great body of water. No. The sea, a sea proper, is one that's surrounded by land. And so this is not a sea. It's the same word for lake in Hebrew, or even a big, what we would call pond or tank or reservoir. So this freshwater lake is the lowest freshwater lake on earth. And so all around it, any way you go, you're going to be going up. And so many times when it says he went up from the sea, of course he did, because you have to go up at the south end where it empties out into the what we call the lower Jordan that runs down, about 90 miles or so to the Dead Sea. It's the lowest point on earth. It's 1,300 feet below sea level, but the Sea of Galilee is 700 feet below sea level. And so all around it are mountains, are huge hills. And so it is a part of that Syrian-African rift that is 4,000 miles long, starts in northern Syria and goes all the way to east central Africa. It is a crack in the earth, and the Sea of Galilee is the lowest freshwater lake on the planet. And so Jesus, in order to speak to these multitudes, went out in a boat. That meant that he went out from the banks just a little bit, where that his voice would hit that water and would go up to those sitting on the bank. And it was like a natural theater. And so that's why he did that. He would have done that probably more than this time. Remember, the Bible's not complete in details. No telling how many times he did it. But on this particular occasion, when he taught this parable, then he went out so that more people could hear him. And it says that the whole multitude was on the land facing the sea, just as I described, like a theater. Then he taught them many things by parabole. The word parable is not an English word. It's a Greek word. It's a compound word. Para means beside of or beside. And then balo is the word to throw or to cast. And so a parabole is a story that's cast alongside another story, or something cast alongside of something else. And in this case, you have an earthly story, but it has another meaning, a heavenly meaning. It has a purpose. And the purpose of the earthly story is not that story in itself, but to teach a spiritual truth. So it's an earthly story with a heavenly meaning. It is a real story that has a spiritual meaning. And so this is what Jesus did. He said, "Listen, behold, a sower went out to sow, and it happened as he sowed that some seed fell by the wayside, and the birds of the air came and devoured it. And some fell on stony ground where it did not have much earth, and immediately it sprang up because it had no depth of earth. But when the sun was up and it was scorched because it had no root, it withered away. And some seed fell among thorns, and the thorns grew up and choked it, and it yielded no crop. But other seed fell on good ground, and it yielded a crop and sprang up, increased, and produced." That it is, it produced fruit. That's the understanding. As some 30-fold, some 60-fold, some 100-fold. And he said to them, "The one who has ears need to hear." And so, as is so many times the case, people say, "Well, what does all that mean?" Well, you just keep reading. In verse 10, he explains the whole purpose of parables. And then in verse 13, Jesus tells the meaning. This is what he usually does. And by the way, if the meaning is not immediately following, it's somewhere else in the Bible that those things will be explained. And it is assumed that everybody knows that. And they know how a sower would do. They would know how he would spread the seed. They would know the instances that Jesus talked about of these things. But now just think about this. Out of the four things that can happen to the seed, three of them are bad. That's right. Three of them are bad. Three of the four produce no fruit whatsoever. That's right. It didn't produce any fruit that lasted. And by the way, anything that God does lasts. And in verse 13, he said unto them, do you not understand this parabole, this story cast alongside another story? How then will you understand all the paraboles? The sower sows the word. So the sower is a person. The word is the seed. Now, this is the way you understand parables. And these are the ones that fell by the wayside. So we're not talking about necessarily different soils. We're talking about human lives. And these are the ones that are sown by the wayside where the word is sown. When they hear, Satan comes immediately and takes away the word that was sown in them. So there's no faith there whatsoever. There's not even anything resembling faith. These likewise are the ones that were sown on stony ground, who, when they hear the word, immediately they receive it with gladness, but they have no root in themselves. And when it talks about stony ground, it's not talking about a rocky field. It's actually talking about a rock bed, that is a shelf of rock where there's just a little bit of soil underneath it, but it does not have a deep soil. And so whatever it is, it's just an inch deep or 2 inches deep, and it's not enough to really grow anything and produce fruit because it goes right into rock. It cannot take root. That's what he's talking about there. And so he says that those, they receive it with gladness. Looks like it's all going to be great, and we're so glad that this happened. But they have no root in themselves, so they only endure for a time. Afterward, when tribulation, that is trials, crushing, or persecution, that is somebody's hounding them or making fun of them, or some other kind of persecution arises for the word's sake that they say they've received, immediately they stumble. No fruit. Now, these are the ones that are sown among the thorns. They are the ones that who hear the word, and the cares of this world and the deceitfulness of riches and the desires for other things entering in choke the word, and it becomes unfruitful. In other words, it looked like something was going to produce. It looked like they were budding, but no, it didn't work. But then he said, but these are the ones sown on good ground. The soil is ready for it. It was ripe. God had prepared it. Those who hear the word accept it and bear fruit, some 30, some 60, and some 100. In other words, they weren't all alike, but every one that is good soil produces fruit. You say, what's that got to do with faith? Well, it has to do with saving faith. You see, there's some that are just like this parable, that they hear the word, they come to church, but the devil steals away everything before they even get to their cars after the worship service. They're already thinking about while they're in the worship service, what they're going to be doing, where they're going to be going, and when will this be over, and when will that guy up there standing teaching or running or yelling or gasping for breath, or when will this boring person, whatever the case is, be quiet so I can get on with sports and other things that I've got planned for the day. That person obviously has no faith. But some fell among the thorns. That is, it looked like that they were going to come up. It was springing up. There was some response, but it yielded no fruit. Some were on stony ground. I'm telling you, they were really going. It was going to be good, but as soon as they ran into trouble, and it wasn't all pie in the sky, by and by, and the bed of roses they thought it was going to be, and was not just all happy-go-lucky, and this was costing them something, they say, oh, no, no, no. But that which produced fruit, and by the way, every child of God will produce fruit. That is, what is a root? That will be the fruit. And if there is no Christ-likeness, if there is, see, the purpose of the Christian life is to be like Jesus. The goal of the Christian life is to be like Jesus. It's all about Jesus. It really is. And you say, well, I'm growing in the Lord. What do you mean by that? Are you more like Jesus than you were? Are you growing in maturity? What is maturity? It's being more like Jesus. It's doing more of what Jesus did. It is being Jesus in the sense of the Holy Spirit is producing in you the fruit. Because you see, the end of our lives on this earth, when we get to heaven, the Bible says that what God is going to bring us to is not to our best. Our best is nothing, but He's going to glorify us. He's going to make us like Jesus. He's going to conform us, according to Romans chapter 8, to the image of Jesus. Beloved, right now are we the sons of God, and it does not yet appear what we shall be. John said, but we know that when He shall appear, we shall be like Him, for we shall see Him as He is. You see, we need to examine our lives and to make sure that we've just not agreed with some doctrine, but there's been no life change. That's intellectual assent. It's not just recognizing the man upstairs and doing reverence to him when it's profitable. It's not making a decision and then your life being just like it was. Maybe you are baptized, maybe you join a church, but there's no life change. You still are just like you were. You know that, and God knows that. If that's the case, then that's not saving faith. Saving faith always produces a love for Jesus. Saving faith always produces Christ-likeness. Saving faith always produces, over time, a desire to do the things of God in your life. For On the Way, this is Tony Crisp.
Thanks for listening to On the Way with Tony Crisp. Tune in every weekday for information on biblical passages, people, places, and prophecies. Fridays are for your questions. Email your questions to questions@tonycrisp.org, then just listen for your question to be answered on Friday's podcast. That's questions@tonycrisp.org. Thanks for listening, and have a blessed day on the way.